Okay.
All right. So it's an absolute pleasure to be here at this very stimulating meeting. Thanks to the organizers and the KATP, and in particular to all the experimentalists in this field who are rock stars, really moving this thing along, opening up this amazing field. I think it feels like it's going to be a game changer. So the work that I'm going to from the body of work that we're doing ever since Pablo told us about his beautiful discoveries, I'm going to speak about a subset of the results. Everything that I'm going to talk about was spearheaded by Yohui Zhang, who's a graduate student at MIT, sometimes in collaboration with Dan Ma, who's another graduate student at MIT. And much of my own thinking on this system is influenced strongly by my earlier collaboration with Adrian Poe, who's in the room somewhere, perhaps, probably in the bathroom, Lijin Zhu and Ashwin Vishwanath. Okay, so there's a wide variety of Moiré graphene systems. So there's Adrian. He'll give a talk tomorrow, which I strongly encourage people to attend. So the wide variety of interesting correlated Moiré systems, that's by now the classic one, 1 year old, magic angle twisted bilayer graphene. And earlier this week, we heard from David Goldhaber-Gordon about the same system, but when it's further aligned with the HBN substrate. This ABC stack trilayer graphene on HBN by Feng Wang, who's also somewhere here, probably. And this bilayer graphene on bilayer graphene twisted to near a magic angle, which Philip Kim talked about, and Pablo also has data on. This twisted TMD on TMD, there's a poster, and it was also mentioned in Philip's talk. And finally, I think there's a talk tomorrow on bilayer graphene aligned on HBN in strong magnetic fields. So all kinds of interesting systems and this interesting phenomena that we want to think about. So so I realized while preparing this talk that probably a lot of the experimentalists in the field expect theorists like me to explain the answers in this field to them. My talk, and in general, I was reflecting that whatever progress we've made on this problem, I'm not sure I have any of the answers, but I think I've begun to understand the question better. So that's what I'm going to describe. So we want to think about how to model these diverse systems, and as usual in solid state physics, the structure of the microscopic Hamiltonian has a band dispersion part, and has a one electron part and an interacting part. And like in any problem in physics, one of the first things we want to do before we understand the details of the dispersion or the details of the Hamiltonian, we want to understand more general things like what the symmetries of the system are, exact symmetries, approximate symmetries, and things of that sort. We want to know, because it's a strong correlation problem, at least intermediate correlation, we want to know if there's a useful low-energy lattice model that will give us a framework in terms of which we can try to address phenomena. And we want to keep these symmetries manifest in this low-energy lattice model so that when we make approximations and so on, that we are faithful to the underlying symmetries of the problem. And informed by this understanding of the microscopics, we want to say something useful for the phenomenology that's observed in experiments. So I'm going to go quickly through the introductory part. Many people have talked about it already. There are active flat bands, relevant flat bands, near each of the two microscopic valleys of the underlying graphene, or disconnected from each other in these systems. This is most well demonstrated in twisted bilayer graphene, where there's the super lattice gap, which is quite significant, order 30 millielectron volts near the magic angle. In twisted bilayer graphene, for each valley, the conduction and valence bands are connected by Dirac points. That's a feature of the band dispersion that, again, has been emphasized many times. But in this other system, for instance, ABC trilayer graphene on HBN, the valence and conduction bands are split off from each other, so we don't have to worry about any Dirac connection or anything like that. So the symmetries of the problem, so the obvious symmetries, the one that's totally not controversial is charge conservation and time reversal. And to the extent that spin orbit can be ignored, spin is conserved, right? Everything else is up for grabs, right? There's not even translation of the problem strictly. But as many people again in this meeting have argued, there's all kinds of excellent symmetries of twisted bilayer graphene. Mollier translation itself, despite not being microscopically exact, is a fantastic symmetry. There are well-defined bands in the system. And in twisted bilayer graphene, there's C6 Mollier lattice rotation, the Dirac points that exist within each valley are protected by a C2 times T symmetry. And if this symmetry is absent, then generically these Dirac points will be gapped out. Okay? So this symmetry is absolutely crucial in protecting the Dirac connection between the valence and conduction bands within each valley. And this is what happens if you align twisted bilayer graphene with the HBN substrate. Then this alignment, this aligned structure, the broken C2 symmetry of the HBN transmits itself to the electronic structure of the bilayer graphene, and then the Dirac points get gapped. Okay, and we saw evidence for that in David Goldhaber-Gordon's experiments. So that's at the one particle level. Now, it's an interacting problem, so we should really think about the full problem. And there's some interesting, excellent symmetries of the full many-body Hamiltonian. Given that the two Billow zones, Mollier-Billow zones, microscopically are disconnected from each other, the charge of electrons in each valley is separately conserved. So it's a valley U1 symmetry. And likewise, to a reasonable approximation, the spin of the electrons in each valley is also separately conserved. And taken together, this means the continuous global symmetry to a reasonably good approximation is U2 cross U2, one for each valley. This U2 includes charge and spin rotation separately for each of the two valleys. Now this U2 cross U2 is in principle broken by weak intervalley Hund's coupling that tends to lock the spins of electrons in the two valleys together. And when that happens, the remaining symmetry is just charge conservation, valley charge conservation, and a C2 spin. Now, I should emphasize the two opposite valleys typically have very distinct dispersion relations. They're related by time reversal, but time reversal by itself, since it switches the valley, doesn't impose serious restrictions on the dispersion within each valley. And therefore, there is no SU4 spin valley symmetry in the system, and that's broken already at the level of the band structure. Okay, so this much I think people know. So we want to think about an effective model for this kind of system. So I really liked Alan's terminology of active bands and remote bands. So there's a bunch of active bands, which is where all the interesting things happen. These are these nearly flat bands, and the bandwidth W is, this inequality should have been the other way around. I was trying to figure out how to write this in LaTeX this morning, and I figured it out, but I got the sign wrong. So the bandwidth W is somewhat smaller than the superlattice gap, and for instance, in twisted bilayer graphene, this is probably of order 10 milli-electron volts. And this separation is probably of order 30 milli-electron volts. So it's not tremendously smaller, but it's reasonably smaller. And typically, the bandwidth is also comparable to some naive estimate of the Coulomb interaction strength. Right? So given this state of affairs, it's a sensible approach to try to restrict to the active flat bands and project the Coulomb interaction to these active bands to get a model which hopefully captures enough of the phenomenology. Right? So it's not like these things are, 100 eV away from these bands, right? But nevertheless, it seems like a sensible approach to not worry about them directly that much. So the question then is there an effective lattice model? And the standard strategy in constructing such a lattice model would be to vanillarize within these active bands to first, just at the one particle level, to obtain a lattice tight binding model, and then include interactions to derive a Hubbard type model, which perhaps might include, oxide interactions, blah, blah, blah. Right? Now, the subtlety with this procedure that's well known is that if the bands have any kind of topological structure, they're topological bands, perhaps protected by some symmetries, or perhaps not. But if there is topological structure, there's an obstruction to writing down localized symmetry preserving one-year functions. Okay? So in that case, a naive lattice model with just the minimal degrees of freedom is problematic, and you have to add auxiliary bands that somehow cancel the topological structure of these active bands to be able to write down a lattice model. Okay? So it turns out that one of the things I want to emphasize in this talk is that band topology is actually very common in these Moiré systems. So in twisted bilayer graphene, I'm not actually going to talk that much about the classic twisted bilayer graphene. Adrian is going to talk about it tomorrow. I think, I didn't look up Andre's title, but you're probably going to talk about band topology as well.
I don't know.
You don't know, all right, very, very good. So Andre will talk about something that may or may not have anything to do with band topology. But the essential point is that in twisted bilayer graphene, the Dirac points within each valley have the same chirality, and that leads to a very, very subtle form of symmetry protected band topology that was first discussed in other contexts by Adrian in his PhD thesis. It's something known as a fragile band topology. It means that you can trivialize this topological band by adding together extra auxiliary bands and convert the system to and build the system from an atomic insulator by adding these extra trivial bands. So I'll leave it to Adrian to explain the subtle form of band topology. But I'm mainly going to focus on many other kinds of Moiré systems where it's not at all subtle that there's a band topology, and so that we are on firm ground, right? In territory that we actually understand and where we can all agree, and then I leave it to other people to sort out places where we don't agree, right?
So all these are only existing in the twisted bilayer graphene, right? I mean, the inference system, the infinite system.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about all those other systems.
Yeah, right.
So many other Moiré systems. So there's the introduction, right? I'm going to talk about these other Moiré systems. Just hold on. Right? So we'll see that in these other systems, there's a more familiar form of band topology where each valley filtered nearly flat band has non-zero churn number. Okay? And opposite valleys have opposite churn number. Okay? So I'm going to illustrate this with two examples. Tenke, I guess I planted you, so he... there are two examples. The first is Feng Wang system, ABC Tailier graphene on HBN. And the other is the system David talked about, twisted bilayer, but aligned with the HBN. Okay, so let's start with the ABC Tailier. So let me remind you, this system actually is really amazing. It's, all these systems are amazing, but each one is amazing in its own way. Right. So this is this paper that appeared last March on the archive, where Feng and his collaborators demonstrated this possibility of a gate-tunable Mott insulator in ABC trilayer graphene stacked on HBN. So you've seen the data. So this is the structure of ABC trilayer graphene. Let me explain whatever Feng already explained. So the phenomenology is that it's a function of it's a dual gated structure. So they can separately control both the top and bottom gate potentials. Thereby they're able to apply a perpendicular displacement field, just like also in Phillips talk. And there is an insulating like peak that is seen at half filling. And of the valence band, and as you increase the perpendicular displacement field, this becomes a strong insulator. Right? So we saw the data in Feng's talk. Now, in the band structure, this has a single isolated band per spin per valley. There's no Dirac crossing. There's no band touchings anywhere. And the experimental demonstration, the striking thing that was demonstrated in Fink's paper, is that you can control the bandwidth by tuning the strength of D. This means that you have control over correlation effects simply by tuning the strength of this perpendicular electric field. Okay? So in this plot, I think the perpendicular electric field takes you in that direction. So you see, and the color, bright means highly resistive. So you go from a low resistive to a high resistive state as you tune this perpendicular electric field at half filling. Okay. So let me tell you what happens in this system with the band topology. It turns out, and I'm going to give a simple understanding in a couple of minutes, that with these bands in this ABC trilayer graphene, for one sign of this displacement field, each valley filtered band has a non-zero Chern number, plus minus 3. If the right valley has Chern number plus 3, the left valley has Chern number minus 3. For the opposite sign of D, the valley filtered bands have Chern number 0. Right? So simply by flipping the sign of this perpendicular electric field, you're able to change the band topology. Right? And by controlling the magnitude of this electric field, you're able to control the effect of correlations. Right? So in this system, you have electrical control of both the correlation effects and of band topology.
Can I ask, these valley Chern state presumably have some edge conductance. Has that been seen?
In principle, you can backscatter between those edges. Right? Right. So there's an immediate consequence of this observation. Given that these bands have Chern number, plus 3 and minus 3, it's obvious that we can't construct valley symmetric Wernicke functions, because if they were, then you're able to construct Wernicke functions for a Chern band. Right? So in this case, there's no question that we can't write down a lattice model that faithfully represents in an outside way the valley U1 symmetry. Right? So there's nothing subtle in this situation. Now for the opposite sign of D, the valley filtered bands have Chern number 0, so then we can play the standard game that we are familiar with in correlated electron physics, write down a lattice model, project the interactions, and in fact we did that, and you end up with a triangular lattice extended Hubbard model with both spin and valley degrees of freedom and various anisotropies. So in the same system, you can tune between standard Hubbard model type physics and something that is more quantum Hall-like. You can't really describe it in terms of lattice Hubbard models.
But you could with an additional band, right?
You could. So I'm saying if you just keep the active bands, you can't do it. Right? It's like in a Haldane model, right? If you had a project to the Chern band, you can't write down a lattice model. But you have to keep extra bands. Right? That's always true with band topology. Right? You can cancel it with some extra band.
You could also mix the valleys by hand.
You could, but then you lose. You don't keep track of a symmetry that I already argued is an excellent symmetry of the problem.
Locally, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I want to keep track of all symmetries, right? Because I was taught that that's a good thing to do when I was a child.
The edge doesn't show gapless modes. So.
Sorry?
You also mentioned that the edge doesn't show the gapless modes. So there's some backscattering between the valleys.
Edges. Valley is not a good quantum number.
At the edge.
Right. Right.
So we don't know what happens at the edge, but valley is not a good quantum number at the edge. All right. So what's the simple understanding of these Chern numbers? Right. So I'm going to discuss it within a simplified model. As you heard yesterday in Ashwin's talk, in this bi-on-bi system, these simplified models are good to get some understanding of what happens. But if you want to make detailed comparisons with, say, someone's experiments, you have to do a realistic map model for the band structure, right? If you want to understand the essential physics, it's good to think about simplified models. So as we heard in Feng's talk, pristine ABC trilayer graphene is a cubic band touching to a good approximation, right? So let's just take that, right? And the structure of the Hamiltonian that describes the valence and conduction bands near this band touching has this form where there's this off diagonal kx minus iky to the power 3 in 4ABC Taillier graphene. And then the effect of the vertical electric field is to add what you may think of as a mass term in this space of the conduction and valence band. And the presence of this mass term leads to a baryic curvature near band touching. So it opens up a gap at the band touching point, right? And it induces a baryic curvature. But the baryic curvature is opposite for the two opposite valleys. Okay? Now, normally, if you didn't have the alignment with the HBN, then these two valley states are connected through the bottom of the band. And so the resulting single band, since the two valleys have opposite baryic curvature, they cancel and you won't get anything. Right? But the Mourier potential chops off the band and gives you these disconnected bands. So then the churn number of each valley filtered band becomes well defined. And the question is, what is that churn number? Okay. Now, the answer for the churn number, I've already said this. So the answer for the exact value of the churn number depends on the contributions away from the band touching point. It depends on the contributions near the zone boundary of the Moiré-Boulogne zone. But we know that it must be some integer, right? Because it's an isolated band. Now the exact value of C depends on that contribution. But what we know is that if we change the sign of D, the displacement field, the change in the churn number must be plus or minus 3. So it can't be that it's zero on both sides, right? So then you have to do a detailed calculation, which we did, and it turns out that indeed that for one sign of D, C is zero, and for the other sign, it's plus minus 3. Okay, so that's the understanding. Okay, so now let me go to this other example, which is very simple, probably not a surprise to most people in the room. But the motivation to think about this is really because of David Goldhaber Gordon's experiments. Twisted bilayer graphene aligned with HBN. Now, the near alignment with HBN breaks the C2 symmetry because HBN doesn't have C2 symmetry, right? And that gaps out the Dirac points. And we saw in David's experiments that, if I remember right, at neutrality, resistivity was at least a factor of 10 bigger than Pablo and Andrea and Corey, right? 100 kilo ohms versus 10 kilo ohms. That's consistent with this breaking of C2 symmetry. Now let's understand, again, using simple models, the effect of this substrate, of alignment with this boron nitride substrate. So let's use the continuum model, right? But now let's add an extra term to the Hamiltonian that captures the effect of the boron nitride. Right? So one effect of the boron nitride is to give a staggered sublattice potential because HBN doesn't have that symmetry. The other effect is that because of the lattice mismatch between boron nitride and graphene, there is a Moiré potential induced by that lattice mismatch, which then interplays with the Moiré potential induced by twisting the two layers of graphene relative to each other. Right? So that's this other term. And this term is estimated in other similar contexts to be weak compared to the Moiré potential coming from the twisting between the two layers. Right? So as a first approximation, we can try to get some understanding by ignoring the substrate Moiré potential. But we have to be careful because in the presence of these two different Moiré lattices, what you get is a structure that's not even approximately translation symmetric. It's really a quasi-periodic structure. So the absence of exact periodicity could be important for some phenomena. And in fact, I'll suggest something that it might affect later on in the talk. Okay?
I have a brief question.
Yeah.
Can you estimate how big the size of the quasi-periodic period would be compared to like a sample?
I can't in real time, but I can try to do it.
Infinite.
Yeah, I mean, there's square root 3 is involved, you know.
I mean, yeah.
One Moiré lattice, though the lattice spacing is roughly the same, one Moiré lattice is rotated by 90 degrees relative to the other. And then if you take the reciprocal lattice vectors, and they're incommensurate, right? Yeah.
So you could tune the twist angle to make them approximately commensurate on different length scales.
Right.
Yeah. So So the Mori potential from the HBM substrate, when it's aligned, is known to open up a gap at the graph.
Oh, absolutely. It comes from, this will already open up a gap.
So you're saying that you keep the effect of the gap generation.
Right.
Throw away other effects.
Exactly. To begin with, as a first approximation. Okay. So within this approximation and within the it's a McDonald model, it's easy to crank out the band structure, and indeed the conduction valence bands are gapped. But more crucially, the really important feature is that though the conduction valence bands are gapped, each of these bands separately acquire a Chern number which is equal and opposite. And it also equal and opposite with the corresponding Chern numbers in the opposite valley. Right? So this, in fact, is a symptom of the more fundamental but more subtle band topology that exists in the pristine classic twisted bilayer graphene system, right? But here it's just manifested in some simple way that all of us can just latch on to, that once you break C2, the bands have Chern number, okay? All right. So there's many other Moiré graphene systems with nearly flat plus minus Chern bands. Actually, the classic work, this field moves very rapidly, so I'm following papers from last year as classic. The other classic work that was influential, at least in my own thinking, was a paper by Song, someone else, and Levitov, Samut Safut and Levitov, a very nice paper, just on monolayer graphene on HBN. So what they showed was that under some conditions, when monolayer graphene is aligned with HBN, that the bands acquire Chern number plus minus one. The only difference from the point of view of this conference is that these bands are not very flat, so interaction effects are weak. Right? So you can study this kind of thing for Bernal-stacked bilayer graphene on HBN. Right? Just like for trilayer graphene, you can repeat this exercise for bilayer graphene. And indeed, you find that this Chern number plus minus two bands with reduced bandwidth in a range of parameters. But it's not clear that the bandwidth is reduced enough for there to be interesting correlation effects that are visible. Okay? And finally, there's bilayer graphene, the system Philip and Pablo have been working on, bilayer on bilayer. Again, in a range of parameters, there are nearly flat bands with Chern numbers plus minus two. Okay?
I thought it could be zero.
It could be zero. That's said in a range of parameters.
Okay.
In this bi on bi system, there's a range. So near the magic angle, if you go to large enough D, both in our calculation and Ashwin's calculation, there is a non-zero.
Yeah, that was the confusion
number.
I had yesterday from Ashwin.
Frankly, I was preparing this talk, so I couldn't read your email, so we'll talk later. There's an email that appeared at midnight from Frankly.
Let me ask this,
yeah.
The tunability of the Chern number implies that it has to be a band inversion transition. Has that been seen?
Yeah, it's not been seen, as far as I know, in any of these systems, right? But it could go through some intermediate weird phase, right? Metallic phase, right? Because once you include all these trigonal warping, all these other things, the small d regime can be more complicated.
Detail matters
for small d, right? But once you go to large d, All right. So the conclusion from all this is that for many of these flat band Moiré systems, but not all, what we have to understand, what I want to understand, is a problem where we partially fill a topological band and there's strong correlations for electrons that live in a topological band. So this is a new kind of, kinetic matter physics problem that at least I don't have much experience thinking about. So we can write down these lattice models only at the cost, Sam, this for you, of introducing auxiliary bands that somehow cancel the band topology. Right? Either it is opposite Chern number, or Adrian will describe sort of an elegant solution in the twisted bilayer graphene, in the classic twisted bilayer graphene context, where you can cancel it in other ways. Okay, so we want to do many body physics in the nearly flat bands, and perhaps they're topological, perhaps they're not. We'll think about all of these in some unified way. So we want to forget about these remote bands and project the Coulomb interaction in the active bands, which have some bandwidth of W. So what is the physics as a function of these two parameters, W and U? Okay, and let me just focus, just like Oscar did, on total band fillings which are in TJ. So nu T is 1, 2, or 3. This notation includes spin and valley. And nu T equals 4 is when you fully fill, say, the valence band. Now, if W is much bigger than U, if U is 0, then we all know the answer. It's a Fermi gas, Fermi liquid metal. And if U is small compared to W, it's a Fermi liquid metal and possibly has some weak instability at low energy. So that limit, unless you go to very low energy, we know the answer. So the more interesting limit is when W is much smaller than U, right? And then the natural expectation is that what you get is a spin valley ferromagnetic order to fully fill a band. So this is an example of flat band ferromagnetism. Right? It's very natural in this context, and that forms an insulator. And we have to decide which of many possible ferromagnetic orders is selected by the anisotropy terms in the Hamiltonian. And for that, a Hartree-Fock calculation is good enough. Right? That selection is easily determined through a Hartree-Fock calculation. Okay, so let's think a little bit more about this ferromagnetic insulator. So here I'll make contact with Oscar Wafek's talk. Right? So the explicit demonstration of the statement that I just made, that when W is much smaller than U, the natural expectation is a ferromagnetic insulator. It's possible to demonstrate that explicitly in a context in which the bands are topologically trivial. Right? So then we can write down a lattice model. Right? And, we can write down a lattice Hubbard model to determine the interactions. Right? So it's similar to what...
When you say this, a ferromagnetic insulator is a spin ferromagnet or SU4 ferromagnet?
Spin valley, in spin valley space. And the selection within spin valley, you can calculate if you know the Hamilton, right, in Hartree-Fock. Right? So how does this come about? So we can understand that if the bands are topologically trivial, so this part of the story is actually very similar to what Oscar was doing. I think all of Oscar's, maybe 20 minutes of his talks is, I've tried to crush it into one cryptic slide, but since you've heard 20 minutes of Oscar, and have to explain. The main difference is that I feel most comfortable doing this kind of analysis in a situation where I know with complete confidence that I can write down, you know, a lattice model without any obsession for topological reasons. So that's why I focus on these topologically trivial bands. And then the projection of the Coulomb interaction gives you on-site Hubbard terms, nearest neighbor Hubbard, some on-site anisotropic Hund-type terms. But the most important term for our purposes is this term, which is an inter-site ferromagnetic Hund's coupling, which is SU4 symmetric. Okay? So why is this there? Right? So the reason this is there is that the one-year functions are fat. Okay? So the Hund's is there for the same reasons as it's there in atomic physics. But once the one-year functions are fat, the electrons will have a Hund's coupling. And this Hund's coupling, parametrically, it's of order U. But it's weakened by the extent to which the one-year functions are fat. Yeah?
No, sorry.
So there's a coefficient GH here, which is non-zero, but it's much smaller than 1. So we tried to estimate this within the continuum model just as a guide to get some feel for the numbers. And GH turns out to be maybe 1 or 2%. Okay? But the point is that it's non-zero in the limit. It's proportional to U, right?
Just for understanding, see, is it the same terms that Oscar said has a coefficient of order of 1?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
You know, the GH is a number of order 1 in some parametric sense.
But you were saying that that term has a coefficient close to 1.
This is a different system altogether. There's a system, you know, this system, okay, on the topologically trivial side, where I'm confident that I can do things right, right?
So even if it's order 1, actually, then the T square over U will also be big. Right?
Let me address that in a few minutes. I'm not sure I'll address exactly what you're saying, but we'll have a discussion of T square over U effects in a few minutes. But the key point is that, you know, there's just the interacting terms in the Hamiltonian. There's also the lattice hopping terms parametrized by W. So this interaction survives in the limit that W goes to 0. And so in the limit that W strictly goes to 0, so you're strictly in the flat band limit, this is the only thing that's this is the main thing that's there that will determine the state of the system, and you get a ferromagnet. And the selection between these various ferromagnets will be done by these terms. Okay? But the point is that in the flat band limit, in the U much bigger than W limit, and ambiguously, you get a ferromagnetic insulator. Okay?
Sorry, those J's are not induced by...
Not by hopping. Everything is just there's just projecting the Coulomb interaction.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, that goes for the topologically trivial side, yeah?
So this term, so all the other terms are just the on-site, the standard on-site projection of the Coulomb, right?
Everything is just from Coulomb.
Are you saying that term that is no on-site, that's the only one that survives when W goes to zero?
There's pair hopping and things like that, but if I'm thinking about insulating states, now that was for a topologically trivial band, but suppose I want to think about these plus minus churn bands, which as I said are very common. So then we don't have any rigorous argument, but for U much bigger than W, it's likely that the ferromagnetic insulator is even more stable than the topologically trivial side. In some sense, the topologicalness of the band means the Wonder functions are infinitely fat, so that should only enhance Hund's type physics. In quantum Hall ferromagnetism is an example of that phenomenon. Right? So quantum Hall ferromagnets are very, very stable. So an interesting case is if nu t is 1 or 3, then the ferromagnetic insulator completely fills the churn band, and then you get a quantum anomalous Hall effect with the Hall conductance of C times E squared over H. Okay? So there's a mechanism to get a quantum anomalous Hall state in these systems. Okay. But as Oscar and Liang emphasized, we are not in either weak coupling or in strong coupling. We are in intermediate coupling. And the main point that I want to emphasize is that intermediate coupling, anything can happen. So we shouldn't be too dogmatic that this is exactly its density way, or its ferromagnet or whatever. We should let the experiments guide us. Right? So spin valley ferromagnetism can win in the flat band limit because there's no kinetic energy. Right? The ferromagnetic insulator does extremely poorly on kinetic energy. Right? Now, if as I increase W, the ferro ordering will compete with other states that do better on kinetic energy. Right? And this you see explicitly in this lattice model for the topologically trivial band. And in the large U effective spin valley model, once you include a W, a hopping, there's an inter-site anti-ferro exchange, which is of order T squared over U, W squared over U. And this competes with the inter-site ferromagnetic exchange, which is of order U, but with a coefficient that's smaller than 1. Right? So the ferro insulator is only stable so long as W is much smaller than square root of GH times U, which is still a small number, right? Because GH is small. Right? So by the time W over U becomes order 1, I certainly don't know, and I'm not sure anybody knows what will happen. Okay, so which means that all kinds of interesting things can happen potentially. Right? I think for me personally, it'd be too close-minded for me to assume that this ferromagnetic insulator is going to continue all the way up to W of order U. Right? There's amazing possibility for experiments in these systems. If you can tune this displacement field and go from metal to insulator, in the vicinity of the metal to correlated insulator transition, what's the nature of the insulator? Right? That's where we think that the ferromagnetism may be least stable and more interesting states perhaps exist. Right? So there's the problem of how does the metal evolve into a Mohr insulator, a correlated insulator?
Why is that where the ferromagnetism is least stable?
Well, I just argue that it's most stable in the flat band limit and this W of order U.
You're saying in the real system W is order U, not the...
It's just this argument, right?
Sure. No, I got this slide. Second slide I didn't quite understand.
But if you got this slide, I'm just repeating the conclusions from this slide.
Okay. Understood.
Saying that there is a weak interaction that selects ferromagnetism and that cannot compete with
anti-ferromagnetism. Exactly. Anti-ferromagnetic exchange, but the lattice is frustrated, so who knows what can happen, right? Keep an open mind. That's the real message of this talk. So there's all kinds of things that are possible. The metal may first become an antiferromagnetic metal, then an antiferromagnetic insulator, eventually a ferromagnetic insulator, or it may go through a first order transition to the Mohr insulator, in which case as a function of D, you should say hysteresis in the resistivity as you do this, right? Or something that many of us have fantasized about for a long time, that on these frustrated lattices, the natural Mohr insulator that you get, the weak Mohr insulator, is a quantum spin liquid, in which case the Mohr transition can be continuous, and we have some ideas on the phenomena that happen near such a continuous Mohr transition, and this system may be one of the best systems to probe the Mohr transition with just tuning an electric field.
So in the last scenario, in the scenario number three, so as the critical point, it's a metal and your insulator.
Yeah.
So the conductivity is E squared over H times.
No, so so the actual thing that happens for the bandwidth tuned transition is that there's a universal jump of the residual resistivity of order HOA squared. I can describe that in gory detail offline.
So the finite surface does not.
Yeah, so this is a fascinating transition because the metal has a full Fermi surface. The insulator has no electron Fermi surface, so the entire Fermi surface has to disappear in one shot if the Mohr transition is continuous. Right? So there's only one example of a theory that I know of for how a continuous Mohr transition can ever happen. And maybe that's been seen in the organic systems. I think Matthew and I have separately written papers fantasizing about that possibility. And experimentalists have written papers too. But it's not entirely clear. Right? So there's lots of, I think, lots of possibility to study this metal-non-metal transition in great detail in this kind of systems. All right.
Talk about 5 minutes and then 5 minutes.
Oh, perfect. That's perfect. I'm amazed that I'm keeping time. All right. So I want to talk about some phenomenology now in the remaining few minutes, inspired by David's beautiful result on anomalous Hall effect and twisted bilayer graphene aligned with HBN. So this is their paper, which appeared strategically just before this conference. Everyone was putting out their papers this week or the previous week. I was delighted to see that Mark Kastner, the person who recruited me to my current job, and was a co-author. So what was seen is an anomalous Hall effect at filling 3 of the conduction band, specifically in devices where magic angle twisted bilayer graphene is nearly aligned with a HBN substrate on one side. Okay, and you've seen this case in David's talk. This is our YX, so this is a hysteresis loop. So the rho XY is estimated to be about half H over E squared, and rho XX is estimated to be of the same order roughly. So the whole angle, it's nearly 45 degrees, right? Roughly close to that, which is very striking, okay? So there's an obvious possible explanation in light of the understanding of the microscopic understanding of the system. So we've seen that alignment with HBN gaps out the Dirac points, no surprise. And furthermore, that it yields turn number +/-1 for conduction bands of either value. Okay? Now, at nu t equals 3, and if the system happens to be in this limit, where its W is much smaller than U, so in the nearly flat band limit, so then we'll get a flat band ferromagnetism, spin valley polarized insulator, with a quantized anomalous Hall effect, sigma xy of E squared over H. Okay? Now, in the experiments, it's not so perfect quantization in current experiments, as we saw. Rho xx is not zero. It's of order HOA squared. And rho xy is not HOA squared. It's 2HOA squared. No, half HOA squared. So there's all kinds of things that we've ignored. We certainly ignored disorder, right? That's for the future. But more interestingly, perhaps, the thing we've also ignored is the lack of exact periodicity due to the substrate-induced Moiré potential. So then it's no longer clear that you really have true band gaps. you may have quasi-localized in-gap states, which can then give you some bulk dissipation, perhaps. Right? So we're trying to study this, but this is a secondary project for us. Right? The bigger question is whether this limit is at all the right one, and whether it's really a quantum Hall ferromagnet, in the sense of completely filling a would-be churn band, if we could ignore this issue. Okay?
Second question, so there's two questions I want to ask. So that's true in any of the twisted layer systems. There's not true periodicity.
But there's a more lethal kind of lack of exact periodicity, because there's two Moiré lattices with almost the same period, which are rotated at 90 degrees relative to each other. Right? So that completely screws up approximate Moiré translation symmetry.
Yeah.
As opposed to, the more usual thing, where there's only a single Moiré potential, so it's approximate Moiré translation, but okay, so this is the obvious explanation, I think. I think David intuited as much himself in his own thinking. So why do you need theorists if experimentalists can figure it out, right? You need theorists to come up with crazier ideas. Right? So I want to propose a crazier idea, right? Again, in the spirit of being open-minded about what may happen at intermediate coupling. Right? So, it's unlikely the system is in the limit that W is much smaller than U. And we know from the experiments that there is valley polarization. Right? Because you see hysteresis. If it's just spin polarization, you won't see hysteresis. Right? So let me just think about a valley polarized state at mu t equals 3, or equivalently at hole filling of a quarter of the conduction band. For intermediate coupling, W of order U. And, yeah?
Sorry to interrupt you, but you said you expect no hysteresis for spin magnetism.
So long as you can ignore the spin orbit coupling, the size of the hysteresis loop will be very small.
Is that an empirical fact about this?
I have about a minute, so should I answer him or should I finish? Boss has told me. All right, so once you valley polarize, but don't commit yourself to anything else about the system, right? So half-filled whole band, but you valley polarize. So quarter-filled whole band, you valley polarize. So then you half-fill, whichever valley you're occupying, right? So what you then have is a churn band with C equals 1 that's half-filled with spinful electrons, right? Now, C equals 1 churn band is like a Landau level, right? So you half-fill a Landau level, everybody knows what you get, right? You get a composite from your liquid, right? So it's analogous to a half-filled Landau level. Now, if you take spinful electrons in a gallium arsenide half-filled Landau level, what you get is just a ferromagnet, right? Ferromagnetic insulator. But that's because no kinetic energy there. Here we have a dispersing band. There's a bandwidth of order W, and U is of order W. So the ferromagnetic insulator, not obvious that that's the right answer. So maybe you can stabilize this compressible metallic state, a spin and polarized composite Fermi liquid. Bert Halperin used to call the composite Fermi liquid the unquantized quantum Hall effect. So here I think we should call this the anomalous unquantized quantum Hall effect. Right? So that's metallic dissipation. And as far as I can tell, current experiments I can't decide which of, if either of these two possibilities is realized. But I think it's fun to contemplate this and think about, what the experimentalist should do to distinguish these different possibilities. All right.
Sorry, Sandal, but in that state, there would be no bulk gap.
There'd be no bulk gap. There'd be metallic dissipation in the bulk.
So, yeah.
It'll be compressible, so if you can measure compressibility, that'd be good. All right. So I think the main thing that I want to emphasize is that typically, in these nearly flat band Moiré graphene systems, it's not the standard kind of cuprate, nictide, correlated electron problem. It's something new. The bands typically, but not always, are topological. And what role that band topology plays in affecting correlation physics, we have to explore. So there's many examples where the band topology is something very simple and familiar. It's where these nearly flat bands have tunable churn number. Okay? But the classic one is much more subtle than this. It's actually the most subtle theoretical problem in this game. right? Because it's correlations and gradients, fragile topological band. And I don't know what issues arise in that context. So there's lots of open questions. Let me just stop.
Okay, thanks very much.